Hello and welcome to Brainstorm, a show exploring new ideas and insights about Ireland and the world. I'm Ronan Kelly. How do you plan for the unplannable? How many risks can a country prepare itself for? And just how are such emergencies and risks changing? If you're of an anxious disposition, this programme is either for you or for you to avoid, because for people who like to play what if, there are three catastrophists on this programme. They are Professor Caroline McMullen. She's the programme director for MSc in Emergency Management at DCO. So she's one of the emergency planning people. The other is Professor Mark Maguire from Maynooth University. He's an anthropologist with expertise in security, especially counterterrorism. And then on the line from the UK, we have Lucy Easthope, who's a professor and co-founder of the After Disaster Network. Mark, I saw in your research a story about Glasgow Airport and the attack there in 2007, which has got to be one of the scariest things. You've got all these people inside the airport. Two men arrive along in a Jeep full of propane and try and ram into the airport. And why is that? Why is that an interesting story for you?
Well, for me, it's an interesting story in part because of what we don't know about major catastrophic events. We make assumptions, and that telling the story of what actually happens sometimes gets the assumptions out of the way, and we can start imagining things in a much more social, scientific, or even scientific way. So the first thing you notice about a major terror event is that a lot of people aren't really spoken to afterwards. So nobody really reconstructs things from the point of view of the public. We tend, as people who work in this area, to focus on institutions, institutional response. So how did the police behave? Did the ambulance crew wait at a staging area before going in? Protocols followed, etc. When you actually look at the inner circle, a lot of people never get to tell their story. They don't go to court because they're not actually material witnesses, or their police don't judge them to be good witnesses. So what I did is I reconstructed lots of different terror attacks from the perspective of that inner circle. And what you find is very unusual behaviours that you just simply wouldn't predict. So sometimes somebody who's who might look physically a little bit frail, maybe a little bit older, turns out to be the guy that steps up or the lady that steps up and does things because they're resilient.
Tell me about the 13-year-old girl.
Well, that was one of the more interesting stories. So this was a young lady. I call her Emily when I occasionally write about her. She's now a very senior barrister, actually. Very successful individual. When she was a little girl, she was sitting in her mother's living room watching TV. The channel changed from, I don't know what was around in 2001, Bluey or something, but 9/11 burst through all the programming, and she sat there watching burning people in a building and, you know, horrifying images. Her mother was on the phone because she was a publisher talking to people in the building. So the whole thing traumatized her, basically. So she refused to travel in public transport, wouldn't go to an airport when planes flew overhead. She had nightmares about them crashing. So she elected herself at a very young age. It's a British thing, isn't it? You know, boarding school, Scotland, trains, Harry Potter. But she secluded herself, and her parents thought maybe that's the best thing to allow her to make those decisions. And again, 13 years old, years have passed, and she said, well, you know, I'm not going to live in fear, so I'll go to fly home from Glasgow Airport to London. And that was the day the terrorists struck the airport. And oddly enough, because she had dreamt the worst, the actual terror attack wasn't frightening to her. And she was the only calm person in a fairly significant radius. She caught her friends by the hands, formed a daisy chain and led them to safety, including calming down an airport worker who was having a crisis, shall we say. So resilience matters.
So she'd done emergency planning in
her head. Yeah, actually, she actually
had. Which
is
what you guys do. Why, you're nodding there, Caroline, when you're listening.
Even more so, it reminds me of Lucy, because if you've read Lucy's book, When the Dust Settles, Lucy sets out how her future path was influenced by her childhood and her aunt and uncle, I think. Lucy, well, do you want to jump in and tell?
Yeah, what was that about, Lucy?
My aunt and uncle are both coroners, so there was lots of learning about disaster and near miss. They never really talked to me like a child, which I think also comes out very much in the earlier analysis. And I think that's something very important for people listening, actually, is a lot of children and young people are coming to me. It's probably the thing I most get most messages about their interests, not necessarily their fears. Sometimes it is anxiety. And we're seeing a lot more people wanting to study and be involved in this area. And for me, it was my community's experience of the Hillsborough disaster in 1989, and that inspired me to work in emergency management.
Really? What was it about that disaster that inspired you?
Well, it was both the event itself, but also the way I positioned myself at a very young age really was that I wanted to be there in the aftermath, which has become very much part of my research interest and also my practice career. So I respond to things like the scene, to the mortuary and the care of the personal effects. So much of what you said already chimes, because it is a different way to live. I mean, that's something I'm writing about a lot at the moment, is to think about these in a different way, not in an anxious or paralysing way, but in a way that
I was going to say, it makes you not want to leave the home like that young lassie if you read too much about emergencies.
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of mums and dads are writing to me saying that their child was like that, but then they've discovered, for example, that there are degree programmes and areas of study. The pandemic seems to have activated a lot of interest in this area. And literally, as I say, I can have 40 direct messages on my social media a week from young people interested in this field.
Right. And it's interesting when the three of you talk about disasters or catastrophes or emergencies, you know, you imagine it might be something to do with like a storm or whatever. But Caroline, you're involved in the National Risk Assessment and you've something like 22 different possible.
That's right.
This is the Irish.
Yes.
What are they? What kind of things should we be worried about?
Well, so we've been doing national risk assessments since 2012. And myself and a fabulous woman, Eileen Tully, who's now in charge of emergency management for the Department of Transport, we've been fortunate enough to help shape the methodology for each of those. So in the early years in 2012, it was mostly about severe weather. So okay. Flooding was the top risk, and cyber and flooding were the two top risks then. So
even back in
2012. And I think what I love about the kind of opportunity I have to work at a national level is that it gives you great confidence and courage to see what's happening and how many really good people are working on these areas in the country. But we often don't see the amount of work and planning. So that's where we started off. And at that stage in 2012, when we looked at flooding, there was an awful lot of work that needed to be done. There was a lot of investment needed. And what Eileen and I, working with the Office of Emergency Planning team, were saying was the outputs from the National Risk Assessment are not the end of our journey, they're the start of it. And if we're going to set out relative risk, we need to then put our time and our money into making sure that we do something with the outputs. So I'm sure you probably will all agree that flooding has been one of the success stories of Ireland in terms of emergency management, because we've put a lot of work into flood defences and plans to try and protect communities. Now, I'm always really mindful when I say something like this that doesn't mean everybody's safe, and there are many people in homes that are flooded frequently. You can't protect everybody, but I think decisions were made and expenditure made to protect the greater good, and areas of Dublin and other towns across the country have been protected. So that was where we started out. It was a lot about weather with a little bit of cyber and a little bit of human and animal health thrown in. And I don't mean that sounds a bit flippant, but I don't really mean it to. And then if you come up, our most recent one was in 2023. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to find the risks.
This is your most recent list.
The most recent list, yes.
But you got up to 22.
When we have 22 risks. And the biggest change, yes, the biggest change is we still have cyber as a top risk.
The HSE is still trying to determine the full impact of the cyber attack, but says it will cost the state tens of millions of euro to fix the network system.
And antimicrobial resistant infections are a critical issue for the country at the moment. It's a different kind of risk. It's a sort of a slowly building one. It's not, you know, big bang or
sudden onset. So this is antibiotics
resistance. Yes, yeah. And it's a major problem for our health service. The public are very aware of it as well, not just the experts. And then we have, so as well as the antimicrobial resistant infections and cyber attack, then our other two key risks are disruption to critical supply chain and pandemic, as you'd expect. So they're the top four of the 22 that are plotted as key risks that could trigger a national level emergency.
Okay, so your risks, your outputs that you talk about are presumably aimed at the general public and policymakers.
Exactly.
The general public probably want to be treated like kids.
No, they don't.
No,
I don't think they do. So we've done lots of work with the public, and we have a Eileen and I call it a cycle of continuous improvement. Lucy will know this phrase from us. And what we like is every time we do a national risk assessment, we think, how can we make it better and how can we make it stronger? So in 2023, we asked the public to rate the same risks as the experts. And they are very tuned in.
So we don't want to have our heads in the sand?
No, we don't.
Oh, that's
interesting. We really don't. And then we did some research at DCU with households and we looked at what level of preparedness 7,500 homes in Ireland had in place. And most people said they were somewhat prepared, but not totally prepared for key emergencies.
And what kind of things do they have?
They have food for more than 3 days. They have an alternative source of heat.
All hands on deck in Dunmore this afternoon as the community grappled with a continuing absence of power. Local businesses have been working to assist people by providing hot meals and other essentials over recent days.
We fed about 120 people on Monday. We didn't know what to cook, we didn't know what to do. We fed twice as many yesterday. And we fed a few more again today.
A short distance away at a specially installed porta-cabin, charging points operate from hastily sourced diesel generators. Elsewhere, businesses have been counting the cost 6 days into the crisis.
They have alternative source of lighting.
That's interesting.
They usually have a basic way of cooking, but maybe it's just a campus stove to heat. But they're really bad at having enough drinking water.
Oh, because we take
really
it for granted.
Bad. We just take it for granted and we think, sure, we'll always get water.
Interesting.
Yes.
Because, Lucy, I think you, in the UK, there's a reference to a go bag and a prepper's kit, is there? What's that about?
That's probably one of my biggest areas of work at the moment in terms of public facing, is that I think the last 4 or 5 years have really seen a big pendulum swing for me around people being very interested in preparedness. When I first started, I've been using social media for about 5 years, and when I first started, if I said something like buy a torch, people would say, no, that's the government's job to keep our lights on. And now people are very much more engaged.
That's
I mean, one of the things that with certainly in the United Kingdom, we are quite far behind other places. And it's quite a common thought in a lot of countries to think about both your go bag, so perhaps going out with a phone charger, a small torch, a bit more medication in case you get trapped away from home, and also what we're calling the sort of prepper's cupboard, which has the 72 hours in. And just like Caroline was saying, our big one is water. Mm-hmm. There was, I think, there might have been a typo recently in an ex post that we saw from an MP that said have 200 litres at home, which I don't think many people could do. But certainly we're trying to increase awareness of things like a 72 hours cupboard or drawer, and also what works and what doesn't. So one thing I'm quite passionate about is torches and storm lamps, not candles. So it's things like that that we're finding a lot of engagement around.
Because we had a funny situation here after Storm Éowyn, when the electricity went out and the broadband went out in certain parts of Ireland. And people were getting their information from elderly neighbours who had battery operated FM radios. And they were completely blacked out. But I would have thought that the UK, I mean, part of your cultural tradition is having survived the Second World War and the Blitz mentality, that you would be right up there at the top compared to other countries in terms of preparedness.
No, we're quite far behind. And also, I think we are struggling a little bit, because one of the things about the difference between the UK and Ireland at the moment is that Ireland has that partnership in civil protection with the European Union. And so things can be done together. So we're both a little bit behind and also a little bit on our own.
Right.
The countries that have tended to really normalise this amount of preparedness are places like Australia and parts of the United States.
And there you've had people out. Is there not a danger of making everybody terrified?
No, we're quite challenging on that idea. And I say it with a bit more certainty now, because we've done so much work in the last few months to explore that. And I finally managed to get a psychologist to say on tape for a radio show that I'm doing that, no, it doesn't. It actually really helps with something that we call startle factor, which is dialing down the cortisol when you're so unprepared. We don't find it anxiety inducing. And I think that's really important to share. And the other thing is, it really, really does engage, as I was saying before, children and young people. We try and keep all of this from them. Where we do need to support people, a lot of people are feeling quite overwhelmed, quite exhausted. We're seeing there's quite a lot of vulnerabilities in society. So things like a storm lamp, both for you, but also perhaps somebody you've got caring responsibilities for. I definitely am enjoying that kind of mainstream feel. So for example, I'm in a lot of magazines this quarter, this autumn, like Good Housekeeping and You and Your Home on the power outage readiness. And I'm sort of loving that. I think that's right. It's softened the fear around it, which I'm here for.
It's interesting, Mark, we were, when the American football teams came over to Ireland in the last couple of weeks, there was reference to cutting down the numbers in Croke Park. And I thought that was just a reference to Americans. But apparently, according to your research, we are actually getting older or heavier and less able to respond to crisis situations. And the reason I mention that is it's all those kind of changes are creeping up on us, aren't they?
Very quickly. So we've done some analysis with a European group that I work with occasionally, that if you go to a standard public event that could be, say, for example, a concert or a football match, you could be looking at one in every five people will have a mobility-related impairment in the next couple of years.
That number.
Now, that number, by the way, of course, which is most interesting, they won't necessarily be there because they won't go out. So we'll lose one in five customers for city centres and major venues potentially. So it's a huge issue. Groups like UEFA are obviously aware of it because, you know, that's how they make their money. But it just in case you didn't find that depressing enough, there's a flip side to it, which is, of course, when you look at the people you expect to come and help you, fire services, police, military, they're also experiencing what you could mildly call a recruitment crisis. That's almost mirrored, actually, in terms of
numbers. Our defence forces are in trouble.
So I spent the last year-ish, well, Lucy will know some of the towns, wandering around the UK, some wonderful parts, ex-military towns, most of them, and towns that once produced a fairly healthy number of soldiers, particularly on top of the army particularly, since 2013 have had a, wait for it, a 300% decline in recruitment. So there's a vanishing of a certain kind of citizen.
Is that because of money?
No, that's a certain type of working class, predominantly men, have disappeared just due to demographic change. Basically, they don't exist anymore as people.
Okay.
So the supply of labour, shall we say, that's a very bad way to look at it, because there's also a supply of values and societal priorities has disappeared. So it's right across the Western world. It's in the US, it's in Australia, it's in Germany, you name it, it's everywhere.
So your area of interest is what immediately happens after a crisis. So are these, is the fact that there are fewer soldiers, fewer police, does that have an impact in that moment, or is it in terms of preparedness for a crisis?
Well, let's just imagine somebody presses an alarm in a major stadium. What we're saying is that in a couple of years, it'll be much harder to evacuate the crowd. And the number of people capable...
Because they're heavier and older.
Heavier, older. Also, other psychological issues, increased anxiety, uses of medication, you name it. So it's a less evacuable... the egress points will become more difficult. You may also have to create what's called citadels within stadiums, so strong points where you can't move people, you have to fortify them. And then you've got a question literally about the level of response. The physicality of the response will have reduced quite significantly. And again, it's not an Irish situation. It's not even it's a global situation.
We've heard from Lucy about how satisfying she finds this work. When you're doing this kind of work, does it depress you?
A little bit, yeah. What annoys me more than depresses me is I think most people who study this type of thing are, and I think Karen has already said this, we encounter very good people in our work who are very interested in doing the right thing and generally try to do the right
including
thing.
Including people in governance?
Including.
Especially.
Yeah.
People
really?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
But sometimes you're kind of building Easter Island statues, if you know what I mean. Mm. It's not necessarily that we can correct course or that we have the full range of information. So I always say to people, the more you can get people with different disciplines in a room to share ideas and discuss what will happen likely, it's not always about predicting the unpredictable. It's about saying, what's going to happen? What resources do we actually need? That's where you get the best conversations and that's where you get real public buy-in. People are interested in resolving this.
So Caroline and Lucy, you're both involved in policy and advice, and imagine the situation like a stadium. that Mark has pointed out, like, that can't be turned around quickly? And also, what's the response? What would you do to try and prepare a society for that?
Well, there's a whole range of things that... So I prefer to push the activity. I'm a little bit different in my focus to Mark and Lucy because I'm interested in disaster risk reduction or
And is this not reducing the risk of a disaster of...
Well, they tend to focus the aftermath, okay, which is why Mark's looking at evacuation. Lucy has made an incredible contribution to protecting and supporting and empowering post-disaster families and communities. But I'm really trying to say, how can we stop something happening in the stadiums in the first place? And we have very good... I think we're quite strong in Ireland on the large events. Or say if you take somewhere like Croke Park or any of the other big venues, they're very well designed. They're designed for safety. In fact, sometimes, and I'm
Which
not going to reveal any
Hillsborough
case studies,
and places like that.
Of course. Mm. Emergency management doesn't improve gradually. You get great jumps in improvements and change after an event. So whether it's the Cold War, as we've been talking about recently in the university, whether it's some of the challenges linked, say, to 9/11. 9/11 was the catalyst for us really taking emergency management seriously in Ireland.
But people have to die for us to take
it's
emergency
It's not that we
planning.
Don't do it all the time, but if you traced the evolution of medicine or accounting, any profession, it's a gradual improvement. With ours, people think, oh, it's fine, everything will be fine, and then something goes wrong and everything's, oh, we better do something about that. But that's just... That's just life, you know. So we do have, going back to the original sort of topic, we do have well-designed stadiums. We have, for events that are 5,000 plus people, we have event plans. We have an increasingly professional sector working on making sure events are safe, etc. What I worry more about are the small events where you plan for 1,000 and you get 9,000 and you have no event plan and you have no event controller, etc. So I do think we need to do more work, but I'd be more interested in making sure we don't have to evacuate rather than what will happen. That doesn't mean, by the way, that we just ignore the rest. Sure. Then we put plans in place for that. But I think it's, I remember, and I won't reveal quite the circumstances, but one of our large venues evacuated too quickly, which is another issue. So they had to redesign the evacuation because you need to be able to manage getting people safely. Sorry. There's lots of things we can do to make it better, but it would be very foolish to ignore the excellent work that Mark's producing and showing. So we need to build that into our plans. People won't evacuate in the time that we thought they would. We can't use models from 10 years ago and assume they'll be fit for purpose 10 years from now.
Just before we finish, I want to ask you a question that one of you suggested to our production team. Lucy, I'll ask you first. What potential risk keeps you awake at night?
I'll be really honest with you. Nothing keeps me
awake.
You are
so reassuring, you know that. I love
honestly,
the idea.
And also there's a lot that makes me smile at night, not least that as Caroline has said, you know, the chance to work with such wonderful people and such wonderful colleagues. And actually it's got easier to sleep as I think more people are becoming engaged and activated, and there's just such high quality research. I desperately don't want people to worry. I do think though, if people are listening, that 72 hours of power cut, no water, it's not something that keeps me awake. It's something I just like to feel, yes, you had that
great,
ready
and we
for
can all
you.
Do it
that,
as well.
That's a hope. Yeah. Yes, it's doable.
Caroline?
I'm going to be really bold and have two. So cyber attack worries me because of the unseen nature of it and the interconnected nature of society. So something relatively small can cause an incredible amount of disruption across all of our services. So that worries me. And also, I would agree with Lucy. We are increasingly resilient in Ireland with regard to energy because we have much better generation of power from wind. But our dependence on the interconnectors into the UK for gas and therefore for electricity still worries me a bit. But we do have the new Celtic connector coming on stream, which will connect us into France, which will really improve resilience. So every time I think of something, I take great heart from the work that's going on in the country and more broadly across the EU.
Great. Mark?
I'll try to be succinct. I was doing some research in Africa a couple of years ago, and a very clever local guy said, it's a quadrant. The biggest friend you have is the state, because the state has the resources to help you. The biggest threat that exists is the state, because if it turns its apparatus on people, it'll kill everybody. But also your best support are people, and your biggest threat is people. And it was a strange kind of quadrant to imagine. But when I teased it out a little bit in my mind, I thought, well, there's one thing that makes us very different from, say, countries like Uganda and Kenya and places like that, where we do have a state. We have these very good people that we work with. Sometimes, however, we do become a little bit too reliant on systems and processes interconnecting. So the same chap said to me that they're now thinking that the real risk is what's called disproportionate collapse. So one piece comes out of the Jenga tower and the whole thing comes down because the systems and the ideas are getting very complicated. So one of the useful things about having this conversation, as Caroline said, we're beginning before the event and the recovery, is once we start thinking about things in that way, we start having a more holistic view. And maybe that's the way to stop the wrong piece that's going into the Jenga, the weak piece, if you know what I mean.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you very much. We obviously can't cover all your research, but I do urge people to get online and have a look at the work done by Professor Caroline McMullen from DCU, Professor Mark McGuire from Maynooth, and Professor Lucy Easthope, who's with the After Disaster Network. Brainstorm is produced by Ciarán O'Byrne. The sound engineer was Mark Dwyer. Brainstorm is edited by Jim Carroll and Aoife Ryan Christensen, with thanks to Tyja Aaron, Research Ireland. And for more, go to rte.ie/brainstorm.